Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Let me say this right at the top. I want to talk about the idea of a Super League being formed in college football, but I'm not in favor of it, right? So we just talked about this to finish off the first hour, and if you're just waking up with us, by the way, encourage you to go download the first hour, search out my name, Clay Travis, search out Outkick. Baylor men's basketball coach Scott Drew is our guest. We're going to be joined in the next segment by John Morosi, our Major League Baseball insider. I'm not saying that I'm for this idea that's coming out of the discussion surrounding the college universe here that's coming out of soccer. I'm saying I feel like it is the best analogy that you could draw to exactly what is going on in soccer. And the best way I think you can think about this is it possible that the money in college football could, in the years ahead, become so substantial that a super conference of sorts could emerge? And if that is true, what might it look like? And so, by the way, early test on this is going to come soon because the Pac-12's deal is up before long. The Big 12's deal is up before long. So the SEC and a lot of other schools are locked down basically for a generation. But there's an argument out there that USC could have a more viable future as an independent college than they do as a member of the Pac-12. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's out there. Texas in the Big 12 has always flirted with the idea of being independent. Oklahoma and Texas are by far the most valuable brands inside of the Big 12. But if we were going to suddenly have like a 20-team mega conference, and I'm not saying I'm in favor of it, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, what would that look like? Which teams would actually be draftable as a part of this breakaway if suddenly the long-term commitments to conferences was not the same? And by the way, the analogy, the reason why I would compare this to European soccer is the English Premier League is kind of like the Southeastern Conference. And Serie A is kind of like the Big Ten. And La Liga in Spain can kind of be like the Pac-12. And the Bundesliga can kind of be like the ACC. And that's the analogy that I would draw. All of these European soccer federations where the teams all compete there and then they compete in a larger Champions League, that's kind of the analogy that you could draw here. Okay? Which teams would be in it? I'll start with you. I just kind of get your read on this, Dub. Do you pay attention to soccer at all?
Yeah, I do. Not as much as I used to a few years ago, but I definitely keep an eye on it. For sure.
Would you agree with my Super League analogy being most apt in terms of American sports now using college football as the example?
Yeah, I think it's a great comparison. I think it checks every box because it really is unique in a sense where there's so many different separate leagues.
Regional leagues.
Exactly. And the only thing you could really compare it to, I think, is college football here in the United States.
And now the positive, I guess, about this Super League in general is it's not as if in soccer suddenly the EPL would cease to exist. So that's the difference and why I don't think it's necessarily going to happen. But if the goal was to make as much money as possible, a lot of times these major conferences don't necessarily make as much sense because there's an unequal bargaining power, by which I mean this. Ohio State is far more valuable than Rutgers. But in conference, they share television revenue, even though there's probably not a single person out there who would watch a Rutgers game over Ohio State that's not a Rutgers alum, right? Michigan is far more valuable than, and I'm not trying to take shots at anybody here, than Purdue, right? Michigan football, far more valuable than Purdue, okay? And there's every conference has a ranked order of what the brand value is of the conference. And so the easy way to think about this is, let's pretend the Big Ten suddenly didn't have Michigan and Ohio State. How much less value would the Big Ten have? I think no way the remaining 12 schools are worth any more than half of what they might have been worth before with Michigan and Ohio State included. And that might be an exaggeration to even get them to half, right? In other words, my argument would be Michigan and Ohio State football represents at least half of the value nearly of the Big Ten as a whole. And look, there are other schools with big values, Penn State, Wisconsin. Like, we can run through what exactly those schools would be, but the larger picture here is the business value of football is where all the money comes from. And I should start there, by the way, of just pointing this out. Even successful college basketball programs are nowhere near as valuable as big football programs, all right? So, who would be like the 20 schools that would end up in a super conference if you were breaking it down? I think the easiest place to go for this is just to look at the overall revenues that are being produced. And that gives you a rough idea, because revenue valuations can, you know, increase or decrease over time depending on a particular year and everything else. But in general, that's where I think you would go to find out where the best revenues are. And this is not going to stun anybody who's listening to me right now in the state of Texas, but the two most valuable college football programs right now, which is the vast majority of the overall revenue, Texas and Texas A&M. So the super conference would include Texas, and it would include Texas A&M. And then I just talked about Ohio State and Michigan. The third and the fourth highest revenue athletic departments in the country are Ohio State and Michigan. And then again, this can fluctuate based on whether you make the college football playoff or whether you make the Final Four on a year-to-year basis. But Georgia, right now, in the most recent year, fifth biggest college program. Penn State, Alabama, Oklahoma, Florida, and LSU is the top 10. And so I think you would be hard-pressed out there to argue that any of those top 10 would not be included in, let's say, a 20-team super conference. Then the 11th most lucrative team out there, Wisconsin. Florida State gets up here, but they have a bunch of subsidies which wouldn't ordinarily be included. I would put Florida State on the borderline. Auburn, Iowa, Kentucky, Tennessee, South Carolina, Michigan State, Louisville, and Arkansas are the 20 highest revenue programs. All right? 20 highest. What about outside of the top 20? Are there any brands that are so valuable you would think right now they would have to be in the super conference? Well, Clemson's listed at 22. I think it would be hard for a super conference to not include Clemson right now just based on how good they are. Nebraska historically has been great. They're at 21. And then you start to run through and you think, hey, what about, like, and by the way, private schools are not listed here. So USC would certainly be included. UCLA's pretty far down the list. Would they need to be included? What about, I think it's fascinating. What states would you decide to put in there? North Carolina, for instance, is 36 on this list. I am fascinated by who the 20 would be. Washington is 23rd. Oregon is 26th. You would want a geographically diverse number of teams, and a lot of places would not want the same schools – in the same state. Notre Dame, Dub, would have to be in this list, another private school that isn't listed. You can see how much of a fight this would end up being if you said, hey, we only want 20. What stands out to you about the revenue-producing schools I just went through, Dub?
Well, regionally, there's not a whole lot of diversity. There's a lot of SEC teams and schools in the southern portion of the United States, which I don't think is necessarily a surprise to anybody.
Yeah, I think so. Let's start here. Like, let's make our list. And we may have to carry this even into the third hour a little bit because this can be a long-form discussion. But let's start with private schools. I think there are only two private schools that would make our list of the super conference schools. I think USC and Notre Dame are it. Would you agree with me on that? I don't think Northwestern would be in. I don't think Vanderbilt. Duke is not good enough in football. Wake Forest. Again, we're not making basketball very important in this decision. Would you agree with me that the only two private schools that would be in our 20-team conference would be USC and Notre Dame?
I would agree, and I think you could put maybe TCU on the outside looking in terms of
private schools. Yeah, TCU's another good private. Baylor has been very good. We just talked with Baylor basketball coach Scott Drew. I don't think Baylor's basketball program is big enough. So I would say we only have two private schools, SC and Notre Dame, all right? What about Big Ten schools? And let's just go with there's no way they could be left out. And maybe at the start of the third hour, because we've got John Morosi coming up, and I want to talk a little bit about Alex Smith, too. At the start of the third hour, we can get into the difficult decisions that would have to be made. In the Big Ten, the 100% in Michigan, Ohio State, right?
Absolutely.
And I think you probably have to also put in Penn State.
I would agree with that.
Okay. So we have like three definites: Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State. In the private school, we got USC and Notre Dame. All right, SEC. And I do think the challenge here is college football is very southern biased, right? And I think you have to think a little bit historically, but I would say Alabama and Auburn are both in, right? I'm going to start off in the SEC West. I would say Texas A&M is in just based on the size of A&M. I think that LSU is in. Those would be the four in the SEC West that I would say have to be in, right? I would also tell you for the SEC East, I don't think there's any doubt about Florida. I don't think there's any doubt about Georgia. I think based on the size of the program and the history and the stadium and the draw and everything else, Tennessee would have to be in. So I think you would take half the SEC, I think definitively, Alabama, Auburn, Texas A&M, LSU, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee. All right, those are definites to me. I think in the ACC, I could make an argument to you that the only two that really belong are Clemson and FSU. And by the way, I might have to circle back up on my private school list. Miami, Hurricanes borderline. I'm going to put a question mark beside Miami because they are a private school as well. But I would say in the ACC, the only two schools that would get in would be Clemson and FSU. I really do think that. All right. In the Big 12, I think you probably are only talking about two schools. I think it's Texas and I think it's Oklahoma in terms of major foundational brands. And then in the Pac-12, we already have SC in. Oregon and Washington, maybe? I'm not sure both of those schools get in. So let me tally where our numbers are. Two in the Big 12, two in the Pac-12, three if you count SC, seven in the SEC, two in the ACC, and three in the Big 10. And I think we need to circle back to the Big 10. And I would say I think Wisconsin probably gets in. And then I think there are interesting questions about Nebraska, because historically the answer would be yes. What about right now? I'm not sure exactly. All right, so let me go through. I'm jotting this down as we go through. Notre Dame in as an independent. So let me count them. I've got Texas and Oklahoma in the Big 12. I've got Oregon, Washington, and USC in the Pac-12. I have got Clemson and FSU in the ACC. As an independent school, I have got Notre Dame. In the Big Ten, I have got Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, and Wisconsin. And then in the SEC, I've got Alabama, Auburn, Texas A&M, LSU, Florida, Georgia, and Tennessee. I think that gets us to 19. And so Nebraska or Miami would be my 20th school potentially to get in. What do you think about that 20 super conference, Dub? Who else would you say has a strong argument? I think if you're an Iowa fan, you could be like, hey, wait a minute, Iowa needs to be in. I think you could argue, I think it's hard to argue anybody other, frankly, than Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, and Wisconsin to be in the Big Ten.
As a matter of fact, over the commercial break before this segment, I just jotted down conference by conference, then independent being Notre Dame, the teams I would put in. I got to 20 on my own, and I have everybody on your list, but I have included Miami out of the ACC as well.
You took Miami over Nebraska?
I did. Just based off of, you know, they both have great history. Miami's certainly more recent in terms of the long-term success, but yeah, I had Miami over Nebraska.
I think there could be a battle in the Big Ten between Wisconsin and Nebraska, right? Because historically, Wisconsin football has been pretty good lately, but historically, Nebraska has dominated if you were looking at the history of Wisconsin or Nebraska. And certainly, this is a Southern dominant list, but the South dominates college football in general. I don't think we'll debate this at the start of the third hour again. So I went ahead and gave you my entire list. I don't really think you could argue for anybody else in the Big 12. I really don't. I don't really think you could argue for anybody else in the Pac-12. And I think I'm being generous putting Oregon and Washington both in, because historically that wouldn't be reflected. You could argue maybe for UCLA, but I think if you've got SC, I think it would be hard to argue UCLA. And you just pointed out, Dub, 12 Southern teams and 8 non-Southern teams, so yeah, it's not
four,
even that
the four
slanted.
Out of the Big Ten. Yeah, three out of the Pac-12 and then Notre Dame. That's 8 teams out of this 20 that are not from the South. So
you think we're being pretty fair here in the way that we are assessing?
I really do, because when you think about college football and the Southern dominance, I mean, dominance is, you would think, more than 12 of 20, I think.
Yeah. We'll talk about this to start the third hour. That's what I'll make the promise on. And I'm curious what Petros thinks about this, too. And we'll even talk a little bit about this with John Morosi when we come back.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
John, you may or may not have heard any of that as you were getting ready to come on, but I want to start there because I think you're a decent soccer fan. And this idea of the Super League, which has provoked all sorts of consternation through Europe with all of the big soccer teams coming together. And I was trying to analogize it, because I know some people who listen to me pay attention to high-level soccer, and probably the FIFA video game has helped. Certainly my kids play that game. I know a lot of kids play. The amount of knowledge of Euro is pretty good. And so as that gets broken down and you think about where it is headed going forward, I just think the college football analogy is an interesting one. You're there in Ann Arbor. And so you would understand that a little bit, I think, of what that might look like if suddenly Ohio State and Michigan, who are the straw that stirs the drink in the Big Ten for sure, decided to align themselves with the major powers of the SEC, the ACC, the Pac-12, and the Big 12, and you ended up with a totally different league where those schools would make a ton more money. And it could potentially be the 25 or 30, who knows, biggest programs out there.
It's a fascinating concept, Clay. I am not a fan of the Super League. I'll say that out to front. To me, I love the tradition of the domestic leagues, and I think the Champions League is a great competition. And so to change that and alter that as a soccer fan, I don't like it. I understand why it's happening. I don't like what it would do to the overall domestic product in each respective country. And from a standpoint of college football. You're right. And I heard what you said. It was fascinating the way that you laid it out. But to me, the one key difference between what the clubs in Europe are doing with soccer and what Michigan, Ohio State theoretically could do in concert with a Texas and a Florida and Alabama is in every other sport, you are still relying on those local teams in your local conference, regionally speaking,
yeah, to, that's a good point,
to be your competition for every other sport, the Olympic sports, for example. And so that's where the complexity comes in to turn around and say, listen, we're not going to play you anymore in football, but by the way, how does this day look for our men's yeah. soccer game?
And to be fair, for the Euros, they're not saying they wouldn't play still the English Premier League, for instance. It would still exist. It would just create even more of a have and a have not scenario because all of these big programs would have so much more money to spend on talent that arguably the top to bottom, the parity to the extent there is any now, would be very difficult to have in an English Premier League. Like Leicester City coming out of nowhere in the EPL and winning at such abnormally insane odds would become even less likely than it already was.
Exactly right, Clay. That's very well said. And the other part of it would be if the Super League exists, and who knows when or even if it'll actually come to pass. Obviously, there's a lot of legalities in different countries involved and who has the jurisdiction over what can actually happen. A lot of different layers to this. But whenever it comes into being, if it does, you would imagine that if an elite team like Juventus, for example, is playing a Super League game in the middle of the week, are they going to run out their JV lineup for the league game on a Saturday or a Sunday, which again waters down and diminishes the product domestically, and there's diminished interest in it from a standpoint of television broadcasts. There are so many layers to this, but in general, for me, Clay, top to bottom, it hurts the overall foundation of the product in your country. It's almost as if they're trying to superimpose what would be a hyper-accelerated American-type league on top of the existing European infrastructure, which is generations old, and you're not doing a full, thorough reboot of the system. You're just putting this new competition on top, and I think to use the analogy, it would just create too much stress on the foundation of the leagues, and there would be a tremendous negative trickle-down effect on the quality of play throughout the ability of those countries to develop players going forward.
Yeah, and it is just really, I mean, interestingly, you cover a lot of different sports, NHL and Major League Baseball among them, but this is one of the arguments that's been made in Major League Baseball for a long time where there's no salary cap and where theoretically the Yankees can come out and pay a level of salary that the Tampa Bay Rays, for example, would never be able to compete with, even though they're both competing in the same division. And the Yankees haven't had the same level of success that you would expect, which kind of goes to the point of, you know, money isn't everything in terms of developing overall talent from top to bottom. And it's really just fascinating. I mean, obviously, Billy Beane and Moneyball brought that to bear. I think kind of started what we maybe say is the analytics revolution. So I think it's really interesting.
It is. And I think, too, Clay, one of the more unique phenomena that have existed in baseball in recent years has been you will have in the playoffs a team that is a revenue-sharing payor, so a team with big revenues that's paying into the program, will play a recipient of revenue sharing in the postseason and sometimes lose. So it's a team that's paying into the system will lose to a team that is receiving money from the system. And again, this really strikes at the fundamental concept of what we want to see from our sports leagues. Do we believe it's healthy for, to use the example, baseball in our country, to have two or three elite teams and then a bunch of other teams that are not as competitive? Is that the optimal way to build the super team, if you will? Or do you want to see hope and excitement in as many markets as possible where you have fans engaged in medium and small markets? We've seen strong starts by Milwaukee and Cincinnati, and they're the 29th and 30th media markets in Major League Baseball right now. If you were to use this Super League mentality in baseball, would those cities even have hope? And does it matter to the fabric of the game that there is hope in those cities? I would say yes, it does matter. And I think that really just strikes to what you want for the best interest of the sport and growing in your country for it to be long term. And now we're seeing all these different issues. Will these players who are in the Super League even be able to play in the World Cup and in the European Cup? These are huge honors for those players. And soccer is one of the handful of sports, Clay, where it's the inverse of the way that we look at sports in this country, which is we look at the club over the country for the most part. We care about the NBA team over the Olympics, let's say. But it's not that way in soccer, where your country is the preeminent one. And I think that creates a lot of really unique decisions for players going forward.
Okay, so we've broken that down in that universe. The reason why I wanted to have you on this Tuesday was because I don't remember this happening in April, and maybe it's partly because the NBA playoffs haven't started, the NHL playoffs haven't started either, but the amount of attention on this Dodgers-Padres series I thought was fantastic for Major League Baseball. Certainly it captivated Southern California, but it felt like many other parts of the nation were discussing it as well. What to you stood out from this series? Is there anything we can glean going forward? And would you agree that this is a rarity, a Major League Baseball April series that felt like in many ways the center part of the sports calendar?
Very well said, Clay, because I agreed with that. Over the weekend, you'd look, and it was the trending topic on Twitter often, was baseball, was the Padres, was the Dodgers, the David Price delivering, Mookie Betts delivering, Nashville, by the way, a couple of heroes for the Dodgers over the weekend, and then the Padres answering back on Sunday. Just some really unique moments, and you had Jake Cronenworth, normally an infielder, pitching for the Padres on Friday in that incredible extra inning game. And so you had a lot of heroes, Clayton Kershaw looking like his vintage self, little controversy there with Jurickson, Profar, and Kershaw. I loved it. I loved it as a fan of the game. There was just an announcement Monday from MLB about how many people have been streaming broadcast during the course of the first few weeks of the season, basically a record-setting amount of time on streaming services over the first few weeks of the season. So some really encouraging data points about just the engagement of fans with baseball. And this rivalry, Clay, I was thinking about this over the weekend. The reason why it's so special, you've got the proximity geographically, you have a fun storyline that we can all relate to of the defending champions, the iconic brand in baseball, the Dodgers, and then their neighbors to the south from the smaller city who have never won the World Series before, trying to prove themselves. So you instantly have an attachment to one or the other, just based on the contours of the story. And then we have interesting characters. You've got Tatis coming back from injury. You've got Machado, who has been a hero and villain at different times in his career. Blake Snell, who was taken out of the game in the World Series by the Rays, traded over to San Diego. You've got Yu Darvish, who's had an incredible career in so many ways. These are bona fide superstars for different reasons, and they're all on the San Diego side. And then with the Dodgers, we know that team so well from seeing them so often in the playoffs. So it's a really unique, identifiable story. They play 19 times this year, Clay, and I'm excited with you. The fact that we are seeing in April baseball carrying the day from a standpoint of conversation is really healthy. I think the Dodgers still have the edge on San Diego, but it was as much as any April game can be, Clay, for a team that probably is going to make the playoffs anyway. That was a must-win for the Padres. They got it on Sunday. They sent a message, and now we can't wait. They're back at it on Thursday already in Los Angeles.
So, big picture here, for Major League Baseball, it has been a challenge to find great storylines that are big enough to captivate outside of regional audiences. You just ran through a bunch of these big names and why, in your mind, that is happening. Is it something that can be sustained, this rivalry, this thing people care about, given how long the regular season is in Major League Baseball?
Sure, it can be. And we've seen it in the past where I go back to the Red Sox and Yankees in 03 and 04, and I was finishing up university in Boston at the time, and so I was living that every day, and every time they played, it was like a playoff game. It could be April, and it felt that way. And it's a lot, it's asking a lot of a younger rivalry, quote-unquote, to add up to a century's worth of history like you have with the Red Sox and Yankees. But I also think that we are at a time, Clay, where years ago you would have never said the Golden State Warriors are going to be a marquee brand in the NBA. Things can happen quickly, and I think it's happening quickly right now with the Padres. They're on the map. They have identifiable stars. We as baseball fans, people around the country, we need Tatis to be healthy and himself, and I'm not sold on that being the case yet. Yes, he had a home run over the weekend, but the overall swings don't look as comfortable as you would expect them to be. So I'm a little concerned about his health overall. But this is a team in the Padres that they're around to stay. They've got a very good organization. AJ Puller's done a great job at developing the farm system. So there's a good model there for them to be a very quality team for a long time. The Dodgers have a chance to chase some history, maybe be one of the best Dodger teams ever with how good they are. So the rivalry's there, the storyline is there. We just need the Padres, I think, to make stronger statements as the year goes along about how competitive they can be for it to truly take root as a great American sports rivalry in 2021.
Last couple of questions here for you. Right now, the Red Sox have the best record in the AL and the biggest run differential. That's a surprise, especially given where they started the season. Is that sustainable in your mind for them?
Great question, because I don't think that they are a playoff team. I did not think that during spring training. That being said, they've got a couple guys who are hitting incredibly well right now. J.D. Martinez, who we've seen be an MVP-caliber player in the past, and Xander Bogaerts, who has that potential as well. Christian Vasquez, very good behind the plate. Christian Arroyo has come up and really been a surprise for them at second base. But the question for the Red Sox is and will always be pitching. And they've got Nathan Eovaldi off to a good start. He's healthy. Nick Pivetta, who they got in a trade from the Phillies, really has, I think, impressed and surprised some people. Eduardo Rodriguez coming back. Of course, he didn't pitch last year due to COVID reasons. So that group of three, Eovaldi, Pivetta, and Rodriguez, has to be exceptional for them to have a chance at really making this a special season. I'm still dubious about this whole idea, but the one thing I'll say, Clay, and why the Red Sox have a better chance than I thought they did 3 weeks ago, is the Yankees look bad.
They really look bad.
Yeah,
how nervous should Yankee fans be?
Yeah, and I think that there are reasons to be nervous if you're the Yankees. They looked at it. I was looking at the numbers over the weekend, Clay. They're the worst hitting team in the American League East against fastballs this year. And if you can't hit fastballs in the major leagues, I'm not sure how much success you're going to have. And they've got some name brand hitters who are struggling right now, and they're older guys. And so when you have hitters who are older, who are not playing well, you start to wonder, is it going to come back all the way this year? What's happening? And they may be a team that's gotten older more quickly than we expected them to. And if they're going to be a mediocre team, the Jays have been okay. They're missing George Springer as well. But if the Yankees are okay to bad, and if the Rays are just okay, then there's enough wins there in the AL East for the Red Sox to have a much more competitive season than we thought. Whereas the Yankees, I still think, Clay, not that we want to overreact to the Yankees, because that sometimes happens early in the season, but this team looks a little old to me. And if I'm the Yankees, I'm worried about that.
Good stuff as always, John Morosi. We will talk to you hopefully next week. Appreciate the time and look forward to it.
Sounds great, Clay. Maybe if Michigan plays Ohio State in the Super League, they can actually win. What do you think about that?
My wife would be happy if that finally happened. I know you would be too, you Michigan grads. Good stuff as always, my man.
Thanks, Clay. All the best.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Hey, I'm Doug Gottlieb. The podcast is called All Ball. We usually talk all basketball all the time, but it's more about the stories about what made these people love their sport and all the interesting interactions along the way. We talk to coaches. We talk to players. We tell you stories. You download it. You listen to it. I think you'll like it. Listen to All Ball with Doug Gottlieb on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot of great discussion coming out of that talk with John Morosi. Still a lot of reaction rolling in to our college football super conference that we will discuss again at the top of the third hour in the wake of the big European super conference announcement in soccer. And I was trying to make the analogy, and I think I've done it in a decent way, with college football. And I'll explain that again if you're just starting off your morning with us in the third hour. We're also scheduled to be joined, by the way, Petros Papadakis is going to join us in the third hour of the program. All of that rolling in your direction. But I want to take a minute here to mention Alex Smith. Alex Smith officially announced that he was retiring. And I got a pretty straightforward thing that I think the NFL should do to honor what I think is the greatest comeback in the history of the NFL. If you have watched Alex Smith and what happened to him on the football field and how horribly injured he was, if you have watched him be able to come back from that injury and play again last season, and you were able to do that and you weren't blown away, I would just say that you need to go back and look one more time at all of the things that Alex Smith had to go through. I mean, they were talking about potentially having to amputate his leg, the number of surgeries that he had, the amount of work that he had to undertake in order to be able to return to the football field. This, to me, is the greatest comeback story in the history of the NFL. And they have a Comeback Player of the Year award that they give every year at the NFL Honors at the end of the season. I think that this award should be renamed in honor of Alex Smith. I think it should be the Alex Smith Comeback Player of the Year award. And just like we have the Walter Payton Man of the Year award, they decided to name the Man of the Year award after Walter Payton, who was one of the all-time great off the field, also obviously on the field, but one of the great all-time off the field guys in the history of the NFL. I think they should honor Alex Smith by naming the Comeback Player of the Year award after him because of what he has been able to do and because of what he means overall to the NFL. And because his story is just so compelling, I think that would be the perfect way to honor Alex Smith's comeback. Maybe it's possible down the line somebody is going to have a comeback from a more devastating injury than what Alex Smith just did, but it's almost impossible to foresee. And for him, I feel like on some level, Alex Smith proving to himself that he could come back and play in the NFL, even though he now is retiring, proving it to himself and playing at times at a fairly high level. I mean, starting quarterback in the NFL, if you were watching and it didn't get a little dusty when you saw Alex Smith come in for the Washington football team, and when you saw his family sitting there in the crowd, and when they celebrated his return to the field, and if even as you were watching it, you weren't feeling a little bit nervous about him taking a hit, I don't know that you have a soul as a sports fan. And so to me, a move that the NFL could make that I think would be fabulous and I think would be great and I think would be a tremendous honor to what Alex Smith did, I think they should rename the Comeback Player of the Year award after him. I really do. I think it would be well received. I think players across the league would be excited about the honor, and I think it would be a compelling and justified act to undertake in honor of Alex Smith. All right, when we come back, we will talk about the idea that we talked about early in the second hour of this show. What would happen if a realignment occurred similar to what's going on in soccer right now and there was a super league in college football? Who would make it? We will discuss it. I appreciate all of you hanging out with us. 2 hours in the book. We'll also talk with Petros Papadakis. This is OutKick. Thanks for hanging out with us on Fox Sports Radio.